Section 2, The Spanish-American War, An American Story. Clara Barton, the founder and president of the American National Red Cross, was working late in her villa overlooking the harbor in Havana, Cuba, on the evening of February 15, 1898. As she and an assistant reviewed some paperwork, an enormous blast lit up the sky. She later recalled, "The deafening roar was such a burst of thunder as perhaps one never heard before. And off to the right, out over the bay, the air filled with a blaze of light, and this in turn filled with black specks like huge specters flying in all directions." Barton quickly learned what had happened. The USS Maine, anchored in the Havana harbor, had exploded. Barton rushed to a nearby hospital, where she took a first-hand look at the blast's devastation. The sailors' wounds, she wrote, were all over them, heads and faces terribly cut, internal wounds, arms, legs, feet, and hands burned to the live flesh. Adapted from The Spanish War. The Coming of War. Of the 354 officers and sailors aboard the Maine that winter night, 266 died. No one is sure why the Maine exploded. The size of the explosion indicates that the ship's ammunition supplies blew up. Some experts think that a fire accidentally ignited the ammunition. Others argue that a mine detonated near the ship set off the ammunition. When the explosion happened, many Americans blamed it on Spain. Cuba was a Spanish colony at the time, but it was in the midst of a revolution. The Cuban people were fighting for independence from Spain. Many Americans regarded the Spanish as tyrants and supported the Cubans in their struggle. These Americans quickly jumped to the conclusion that Spain had blown up the Maine. Within a matter of weeks, Spain and the United States were at war. Although the fighting only lasted a few months, the outcome dramatically altered the position of the United States on the world stage. The Cuban Rebellion begins. Cuba was one of Spain's oldest colonies in the Americas. Its sugarcane plantations generated considerable wealth for Spain and produced nearly one-third of the world's sugar in the mid-1800s. Until Spain abolished slavery in 1886, about one-third of the Cuban population was enslaved and forced to work for wealthy landowners on the plantations. In 1868, Cuban rebels declared independence and launched a guerrilla war against Spanish authorities. Lacking internal support, the rebellion collapsed in 1878. Many Cuban rebels then fled to the United States, where they began planning a new revolution. One of the exiled leaders was José Martí, a writer and poet who was passionately committed to the cause of Cuban independence. While living in New York City in the 1880s, Martí brought together different Cuban exile groups living in the United States. The groups raised funds from sympathetic Americans, purchased weapons, and trained their troops in preparation for the invasion of Cuba. By the early 1890s, the United States and Cuba had become closely linked economically. Cuba exported much of its sugar to the United States, and Americans had invested approximately $50 million in Cuba's mines, railroads, and sugar plantations. These economic ties created a crisis in 1894 when the United States imposed new tariffs, including a tariff on sugar, in an effort to protect its troubled economy from foreign competition. The new tariff wrecked the sale of Cuban sugar in the United States and devastated the island's economy. With the Cuba in an economic crisis, Martí's followers launched a new rebellion in February 1895. Although Martí died in battle shortly after returning to Cuba, the revolutionaries seized control of eastern Cuba, declared independence, and formally established the Republic of Cuba in September 1895. Americans support the Cubans. When the uprising in Cuba began, President Grover Cleveland declared the United States neutral. Outside the White House, however, much of the public openly supported the rebels. Some citizens compared the Cuban struggle to the American Revolution. A few sympathetic Americans even began smuggling guns from Florida to the Cuban rebels. What led most Americans to support the rebels were the dramatic stories of Spanish atrocities reported in two of the nation's major newspapers, the New York Journal and the New York World. The Journal, owned by William Randolph Hearst, and the World, owned by Joseph Pulitzer, competed with each other to increase their circulation. The Journal reported outrageous stories of the Spanish feeding Cuban prisoners to sharks and dogs. Not to be outdone, the World described Cuba as a place with blood on the roadsides, blood in the fields, blood on the doorsteps, blood, blood, blood. This kind of sensationalist reporting, in which writers often exaggerated or even made up stories to attract readers, became known as yellow journalism. Although the press invented sensational stories to sell more papers, there is no doubt that the Cuban people indeed suffered horribly. The Spanish dispatched nearly 200,000 troops to the island to put down the rebellion and appointed General Valeriano Weyler to serve as governor. Weyler's harsh policies quickly earned him the nickname El Carnicero, or the Butcher. The Cuban rebels carried out a guerrilla war. They staged hit-and-run raids, burned plantations and sugar mills, tore up railroad tracks, and attacked supply depots. The rebels knew that many American businesses had invested in Cuba's railroads and plantations. They hoped that the destruction of American property would lead to American intervention in the war. To prevent Cuban villagers from helping the rebels, Weyler herded hundreds of thousands of rural men, women, and children into reconcentration camps, where tens of thousands died of starvation and disease. News reports of this brutal treatment of civilians enraged Americans and led to renewed calls for American intervention in the war. Calling out for war. In 1897, Republican William McKinley became President of the United States. The new president did not want to intervene in the war, believing it would cost too many lives and hurt the economy. In September 1897, he asked the Spanish if the United States could help negotiate an end to the conflict. He made it clear that if the war did not end soon, the United States might have to intervene. Pressed by McKinley, the Spanish government removed Weyler from power. Spain then offered the Cubans autonomy, the right to their own government, but only if Cuba remained part of the Spanish Empire. The Cuban rebels refused to negotiate. They wanted full independence. Spain's concessions to the rebels enraged many Spanish loyalists in Cuba. In January 1898, the loyalists rioted in Havana. Worried that American citizens in Cuba might be attacked, McKinley made the fateful decision to send the battleship Maine to Havana in case the Americans had to be evacuated. In February 1898, the New York Journal printed a private letter written by Enrique Dupé de Lome, the Spanish ambassador to the United States. A Cuban agent had intercepted the letter and delivered it to the paper. It described McKinley as weak and a bitter for the admiration of the crowd. The nation erupted in fury over the insult. Ambassador de Lome resigned, but before the Fuhrer could die down, the Maine exploded in the Havana harbor. The press promptly blamed Spain. Rapidly responding to the hysterical anger of the American public, Congress unanimously authorized the president to spend $50 million for war preparations. Shortly afterward, on March 28, 1898, a naval court of inquiry concluded that a mine had destroyed the Maine. Throughout America, people began using the slogan, "Remember the Maine," as a rallying cry for war. By early April, President McKinley was under tremendous pressure to go to war. American mobs were demonstrating in the streets against Spain and against McKinley for refusing to go to war. Within the Republican Party, jingoism, or an attitude of aggressive nationalism, was very strong, especially among younger members of the party. These members were furious at McKinley for not declaring war. Assistant Secretary of the Navy Theodore Roosevelt, for one, raged that McKinley had no more backbone than a chocolate eclair. Many Democrats were also demanding war, and Republicans feared that if McKinley did not go to war, the Democrats would win the presidency in 1900. Finally, on April 11, 1898, McKinley asked Congress to authorize the use of force to end the conflict in Cuba. On April 19th, Congress declared Cuba independent, demanded that Spain withdraw from the island, and authorized the president to use armed force if necessary. In response, on April 23rd, Spain declared war on the United States. For the first time in 50 years, the United States was at war with another nation. Reading check. Examining. What conditions led to the Cuban Rebellion in 1895? A war on two fronts. The Spanish and Cuba were not prepared for war. Tropical diseases and months of hard fighting had weakened their soldiers. Their warships were old and their crews poorly trained. The United States had more battleships, and both sides knew that the war ultimately would be decided at sea. If the United States could defeat Spain's fleet, the Spanish would not be able to get supplies to its troops in Cuba. Eventually, they would have to surrender. The United States takes the Philippines. The United States Navy was ready for war with Spain. The Navy's North Atlantic Squadron blockaded Cuba, and the American fleet based in British Hong Kong was ordered to attack the Spanish fleet in the Philippines. The Philippines was a Spanish colony, and American naval planners were determined to prevent the fleet there from sailing east to attack the United States. A short time after midnight on May 1, 1898, Commodore George Dewey led his squadron into Manila Bay in the Philippines. As dawn broke, Dewey's fleet opened fire and rapidly destroyed the severely outgunned Spanish warships. Dewey's quick victory took McKinley and his advisors by surprise. The army was not yet ready to send troops to help Dewey capture the Philippines. Hastily, the army assembled 20,000 troops to sail from San Francisco to the Philippines. On the way to the Philippines, the American troops also seized the island of Guam, another Spanish possession in the Pacific. While waiting for the American troops to arrive, Dewey contacted Emilio Aguinaldo, a Filipino revolutionary leader who had staged an unsuccessful uprising against the Spanish in 1896. Aguinaldo quickly launched a new guerrilla war. At first, Aguinaldo believed the Americans were his allies, but when American troops arrived in the islands, he became suspicious. The Americans quickly seized the Philippine capital of Manila from the Spanish, but refused to allow Aguinaldo's forces into the city. They also refused to recognize his rebel government. Hostility between the Filipinos and the Americans began to grow as both sides waited for the war with Spain to end. American forces battle in Cuba. Unlike the mobilization of the Navy, which had been very efficient, the mobilization of the American Army was very poorly conducted. Although volunteers flooded into Army training camps, the Army lacked the resources to train and equip them. In many camps, conditions were so unsanitary that epidemics broke out and hundreds of Americans died. By the end of the war, far more Americans had died in training camps than in actual battle. Finally, on June 14, 1898, a force of about 17,000 troops landed on the southern coast of Cuba, east of the city of Santiago. A Spanish fleet occupied Santiago Harbor, where it was well protected by powerful shore-based guns. American military planners wanted to capture those guns in order to drive the Spanish fleet out of the harbor and into battle with the American fleet waiting nearby. Among the American troops advancing toward Santiago was a volunteer cavalry unit from the American West. They were a flamboyant mix of cowboys, miners, and law officers known as the Rough Riders. The commander of the Rough Riders was Colonel Leonard Wood. Second in command was Theodore Roosevelt, who had resigned from his post as Assistant Secretary of the Navy to join the fight. On July 1st, American troops attacked the village of El Caney, northeast of Santiago. Another force attacked the San Juan Heights, a series of hills overlooking the main road to Santiago. While one group of soldiers attacked San Juan Hill, the Rough Riders, who were on foot, not horseback, attacked Kettle Hill. After seizing Kettle Hill, Roosevelt and his men assisted in the capture of San Juan Hill. The Rough Riders did not make their attack alone. Accompanying them up Kettle Hill were the all-black 9th and 10th Cavalry Regiments. many African Americans had responded to the call for volunteers, and roughly one-fourth of the American troops fighting in Cuba were African American. Four African American soldiers received the Medal of Honor for their bravery during the war. The Spanish commander in Santiago panicked after American victories at El Caney and the San Juan Heights. He immediately ordered the Spanish fleet in the harbor to flee. As the Spanish ships raced out of the harbor on July 3rd, the American warships guarding the entrance attacked them. In the ensuing battle, the American squadron sank or beached every Spanish vessel. Spanish resistance in Cuba ended with the surrender of Santiago 2 weeks later. Soon after, American troops occupied the nearby Spanish colony of Puerto Rico. On August 12, 1898, Spain and the United States agreed to a ceasefire. Reading check. Describing. How prepared was the U.S. Army to fight a war against Spain? An American empire is born. As American and Spanish leaders met to discuss the terms for a peace treaty, Americans debated what to do about their newly acquired lands. Cuba would be given its freedom as promised, and Spain had agreed that the United States would annex Guam and Puerto Rico. The big question was what to do with the Philippines. The United States faced a difficult choice: remain true to its Republican ideals or become an imperial power. The debate over annexation. Many supporters of annexing the Philippines emphasized the economic and military benefits of taking the island. They would provide the United States with a naval base in Asia, a stopover on the way to China, and a large market for American goods. Other supporters believed America had a duty to teach less civilized people how to live properly. "Surely this Spanish war has not been a grab for empire," commented a New England minister, "but a heroic effort to free the oppressed and to teach the millions of ignorant, debased human beings thus freed how to live." Not all Americans supported annexation. Anti-imperialists included industrialist Andrew Carnegie, social worker Jane Addams, writer Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, and the leader of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers. Carnegie argued that the cost of an empire far outweighed the economic benefits it provided. Gompers worried that competition from cheap Filipino labor would drive down American wages. Adams, Clemens, and others believed imperialism violated American principles. President McKinley had to decide what to do with the Philippines. Ultimately, he decided to annex the islands. He later explained his reasoning to a group of ministers. "And one night late, it came to me this way. One, that we could not give them back to Spain, that we would be cowardly and dishonorable. Two, that we could not turn them over to France or Germany, that would be bad for business and discreditable. Three, that we could not leave them to themselves, they were unfit for self-government. And four, that there was nothing left for us to do but take them all and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them." Quoted in A Diplomatic History of the American People. On December 10, 1898, the United States and Spain signed the Treaty of Paris. Under the treaty, Cuba became an independent country, and the United States acquired Puerto Rico and Guam and agreed to pay Spain $20 million for the Philippines. After an intense debate, the Senate ratified the treaty in February 1899. The United States had become an imperial power. Rebellion in the Philippines. The United States quickly learned that controlling its new empire would not be easy. Amelia Aguinaldo called the American decision to annex his homeland a violent and aggressive seizure. He then ordered his troops to attack the American soldiers in the Philippines. To fight the Filipino guerrillas, General Arthur MacArthur, the father of the future American General Douglas MacArthur, adopted many of the same policies that America had condemned Spain for using in Cuba. MacArthur set up reconcentration camps to separate guerrillas from civilians. The results were also similar to what had happened in Cuba. Thousands of Filipinos died from disease and starvation. While MacArthur fought the guerrillas, the first U.S. civilian governor of the islands, William Howard Taft, tried to win over the Filipino people by reforming education, transportation, and health care. New railroads, bridges, and telegraph lines strengthened the economy. A public school system was set up, and new health care policies virtually eliminated severe diseases such as cholera and smallpox. These reforms slowly reduced Filipino hostility. In March 1901, American troops captured Aguinaldo. The following month, Aguinaldo accepted American control of the islands and called on the guerrillas to surrender. By summer 1902, the United States had declared the war over. Eventually, the United States allowed the Filipinos a greater role in governing their own country. By the mid-1930s, they were permitted to elect their own Congress and president. Finally, in 1946, the United States granted independence to the Philippines. Government. Governing Puerto Rico. Another pressing question facing the United States government was how to govern Puerto Rico. In 1900, Congress passed the Foraker Act, making Puerto Rico an unincorporated territory. This meant that Puerto Ricans were not U.S. citizens and had no constitutional rights. The act also stated that Congress could pass whatever laws it wanted for the island. Congress gradually allowed the inhabitants of Puerto Rico a certain degree of self-government. In 1917, the United States made Puerto Rican citizens of the United States. In 1947, the island was allowed to elect its own governor. At this time, a debate began over whether to grant Puerto Rico statehood, allow it to become an independent country, or continue it as a commonwealth of the United States. This debate over Puerto Rico's status continues today. Cuba and the Platt Amendment. After the war, the United States established a military government in Cuba. Although the United States had promised to grant Cuba its independence, President McKinley took steps to ensure that Cuba would remain tied to the United States. He allowed the Cubans to prepare a new constitution for their country, but he attached conditions. A special amendment that Senator Orville Platt attached to the 1901 Army Appropriations Bill described those conditions. The Platt Amendment specified the following. 1. Cuba could not make any treaty with another nation that would weaken its independence or allow another foreign power to gain territory in Cuba. 2. Cuba had to allow the United States to buy or lease naval stations in Cuba. 3. Cuba's debts had to be kept low to prevent foreign countries from landing troops to enforce payment. And 4. The United States would have the right to intervene to protect Cuban independence and keep order. Although the Cubans rejected the Platt Amendment at first, they quickly realized that unless they accepted it, the United States would maintain its military government of the island. Reluctantly, they added the amendment to their constitution. The Platt Amendment governed relations between the United States and Cuba until its repeal in 1934. It effectively made Cuba an American protectorate. Reading check. Explaining. What were the arguments for and against establishing an American empire? You're the historian. Who sank the Maine? During Cuba's revolt against Spain, the American battleship Maine dropped anchor in the Havana Harbor to protect American interests in Cuba. On the night of February 15, 1898, the ship exploded and 266 Americans lost their lives. The United States sent a court of inquiry to Havana on February 21st. Despite the lack of evidence concerning the source of the explosion, American newspapers and many public officials claimed that Spain was responsible. Pressured on all sides, President McKinley sent Spain an ultimatum that led to war. Who or what really sank the Maine? From the commander and an early interview. Telegraph from the commander of the Maine to the Secretary of the Navy, February 15th. Maine blown up in Havana Harbor at 9:40 tonight and destroyed. Many wounded and doubtless more killed or drowned. Public opinion should be suspended until further report. Many Spanish officers, including representatives of General Blanco, now with us to express sympathy. Captain Charles D. Sigsbee. The Court of Inquiry was interested in discovering whether the explosion had come from inside or outside the ship. If it came from inside, was it sabotage or an accident? If it came from outside, who or what caused it? Before the court met, the Washington Evening Star published a February 18th interview with the U.S. Navy's leading ordnance expert. "We know of no instances where the explosion of a torpedo or mine under the ship's bottom has exploded the magazine, the powder and explosives within. It has simply torn a great hole in the side or bottom, through which water entered and in consequence of which the ship sunk. Magazine explosions, on the contrary, produce effects exactly similar to the effects of the explosion on the main. When it comes to seeking the cause of the explosion of the main's magazine, we should naturally look not for the improbable or unusual causes. The most common of these is through fires in the bunkers." Philip R. Alger. From the inquiry and later reports. As the Court of Inquiry concluded its investigation, it considered reports of the divers who examined the main and evidence that suggested there had been two explosions. On March 11, 1898, Lieutenant Commander Adolph Merricks, Judge Advocate of the Court of Inquiry, questioned Commander George A. Converse, who was brought in as a technical expert. Merricks: "Looking at the plan of the main's forward 10-inch and 6-inch magazines, would it be possible for them to have exploded, torn out the ship's side on both sides, and leave that part of the ship forward a frame 18 or so waterborne as to raise the after portion of that part of the ship, drag it aft, and bring the vertical keel into the condition you see in the sketch?" Converse: "It is difficult for me to realize that that effect could have been produced by an explosion of the kind supposed." Merricks: "Do you think, then, necessarily, there must have been an underwater mine to produce these explosions?" Converse: "Indications are that an underwater explosion produced the conditions there. In 1911, the U.S. Navy raised the main from Havana's harbor. The Navy's Board of Inspection re-examined the ship, and its findings were similar to those of 1898. Then, in 1976, Admiral H.G. Rickover and other naval historians gathered a team of experts to examine the official court records of 1898 and 1911. The team's conclusions were very different. 1911 Board Conclusion: "The board finds that the injuries to the bottom of the main above described were caused by the explosion of a charge of a low form of explosive exterior to the ship between frames 28 and 31. H.G. Rickover Team Conclusion: "The general character of the overall wrecked structure of the main, with hull sides and whole deck structures peeled back, leaves no doubt that a large internal explosion occurred. The mines available in 1898 are believed to have been incapable of igniting the main magazine if they exploded on the harbor bottom or against the ship's side. It is most unlikely that the main explosion was indeed initiated by a mine. The available evidence is consistent with an internal explosion alone. The most likely source was heat from a fire in the coal bunker adjacent to the 6-inch reserve magazine."